I would like to thank Will for inviting me here. It's my great pleasure to be here. It's the first time I visit the Institute, and I am amazed. It's very, very nice. So I'm a pure mathematician. My background is mathematics. What I do is I study questions arising relativity. One of my priorities, although I'm a pure mathematician, is to try to address questions that might be of interest to physicists and not just to solve mathematical problems. So the questions that I am mostly interested in are questions that have to do with extremal black holes. Today I would like to show you some results about extremal black holes. The work that I will mention is joined with my collaborators, Angelopoulos, who is at Caltech, and Guides, who is at Cambridge. Oops. How do we do this? Sorry. Okay, so the main question I would like to understand is if there is an observational signature for extremal black holes. So here we have a domain of outer communication of a black hole. This black hole assumes it's extremal. This is null infinity. This blue thing represents a perturbation, a local perturbation of the black hole. And so this perturbation will be radiated. So some information will be radiated to infinity. And what I would like to understand is if we measure only this, the trace of this radiation at infinity, if the only information we have available is this, what comes at infinity, then if we can conclude that what we measured here corresponds to a perturbation of an extremal black hole. So by measuring things at infinity, can we conclude that the source of that thing was due to the perturbation of an extremal black hole or not? So this is what I mean by observational signature. Before I give you the result, let me just spend a few minutes to explain why one would be interested in studying extremal black holes. One question would be that one issue that one could have is that extremal black holes are non-generic, so why should we study them? The Schwarzschild solution is also non-generic, the Kerr family itself is non-generic, so it's not the non-genericity the issue. So the main actual problem is the stability. You would like to understand if these spacetimes are stable or not. So you would like to understand their overall dynamics. And as we will see, these signatures are related to their dynamics. So there are various other properties of extremal black holes. So they satisfy various uniqueness properties. They minimize the mass, or they saturate various geometric inequalities. So they have interesting mathematical properties, but they are also important in theoretical physics. There have also been some works on signatures, which are of different kind than the ones that I will talk about today. And Lewis also has work and produce very interesting results about the dynamics of extremal black holes. So there is quite a lot of, let's say, theoretical work, but there is also some work in astrophysics and astronomical community. So there is a quite large literature in astronomy that suggests that near extremal black holes might be abundant in the universe. I'm not saying that this is true. I'm just saying that this literature exists. I don't know anything more about this. So I graduated at Cambridge, and I was a member of Trinity College. And at that time, the master of that college was Martin Rees. And at that time, our master wrote that paper. Then he stated that the spin distribution of black holes is heavily skewed towards fast-rotating black holes, and that about 70% of all black holes at all epochs are maximally rotating. So this was a motivation for me to study extremal black holes. Okay. Also, very recently, there was some work from people at Princeton where they claim that in the advanced LIGO data, you can find collisions of highly spinning black holes. So there is evidence of the existence of near extremal things, even from detecting gravitational waves, not just based on X-ray observations as in all the previous works. So there is some interest for these black holes, both from. How big what?
An error bars. This one, they claim a low bar on the plasma.
Well, but those are not necessarily real events. The Princeton people are not claiming with high confidence that the cases where you have a significant effective spin are real. Those are the less certain of their events. But since we're talking now, there are many circumstances in which a genuinely extremal black hole, one of AOVRM of 1, is very different from an AOVRM of, say, 0.99. And I think that when Martin Rees was describing this, he didn't actually mean AOVRM of 1, because there are demonstrations you can't get there from astrophysical properties. But nonetheless, it's close enough for you.
So I will comment about this in a second, but I am a mathematician, right? And in the mathematical community, most people worry about the Schwarzschild solution, where A over M is zero. So if for them 0.99 or 1 is the same, but I completely agree with you. It's not the same at all. Like 0.99 is almost infinitely far away from one. And part of our work also demonstrates this. Okay, so the problem that I will address today is the simplest problem one can address, which is that of understanding in the domain of outer communications the solutions to the linear, homogeneous, decoupled wave equation. So we fixed our background, and on that background, we study the evolution of solutions to the linear wave equations. So we study the evolution of scalar perturbations. This is the simplest TOEI model in understanding the dynamics of the actual space-time in the context of the actual Einstein equations. The hope is that the features of solutions to these equations are inherited also by the solutions to the Einstein equations. The only difference is that this problem is much, much easier to study. Okay, so today we'll study scalar perturbations. And we will assume, right, that initially we have initial data which are localized very close to the event horizon on an initial surface. And what we will do is we will see how this initial scalar perturbation evolves in the future. And we will study the evolution along the event horizon as the advanced time progresses in the domain of outer communication. And also we study the evolution on null infinity as the retarded time goes to infinity. So everywhere in the domain of outer communications. So here is our initial perturbation. It will evolve. And as I said, we want to understand what happens on the event horizon, what happens as we go to time like infinity from bounded regions, and what happens on null infinity here. And as I said, I would like to know if somehow by simply knowing what arrives here, we can conclude that the actual black hole here was extremal or not. So before we even try to write an expression that quantifies what I just said, we need to realize that this is classical physics. So if this perturbation is very localized around the event horizon initially, then this perturbation will be felt by null infinity at very late times of null infinity. So if I have a perturbation here, this perturbation will never radiate anything here in this region, because this is not in the domain of influence of our perturbation. So if our perturbation is supported very close to the event horizon, then it will be understood by null infinity at very late times. So our result necessarily must understand the asymptotics of our perturbation along null infinity. It's these asymptotics here that will tell us whether the perturbation was of an extreme black hole or not. So without doing an asymptotic analysis, we will not be able to obtain a rigorous, let's say, classical observational signature for extreme black holes. Okay. And when I say asymptotic analysis, I mean that we need to derive the precise late time asymptotics for our perturbations and for its radiation field along null infinity. And when I say late time asymptotics, I mean we need to go beyond, you know, the standard quasi-normal mode regime, and we need to really see at the power law tails, the really late time, like time goes to infinity. So let's define this quantity. This is a quantity of our perturbation psi, and this is a quantity that we define on null infinity. So we are at retard time u. U is the time at null infinity. So u is zero here, and u is infinity here. So we are at time t, and theta is simply the angle on null infinity we are at. Okay? Null infinity is parameterized by angles, so theta is the angle. So with the RPC is the radiation field at the point where we are at, 1 over 4 m is the mass, and u squared is simply time squared. That's the one term of our expression, and the other term is this constant times this integral. So we integrate on null infinity from times 0 up to the time we are now the radiation field. So point-wise, the radiation field at the point where we are at, rescaled by the square of time. And we also integrate the radiation field in the past. That's our expression. So for every time u, that expression at u, comma theta is finite, because everything here is finite. R is the radius. Okay. So the radius of null infinity is infinite, but the scalar field itself is 0 there. So this rescaled version of the scalar field, so it's finite. Okay, this is the finite trace that the scalar field leaves on null infinity. Okay, so the first result is that in both so I will talk about the Reisen-Ostrom family. So I will talk about the sub-extremal Reisen-Ostrom and the extremal Reisen-Ostrom. So the first result is that for all perturbations, with initial data supported close to the event horizon, regardless of whether the black hole is sub-extremal Reisen-Ostrom or extremal Reisen-Ostrom, that expression, the limit, sorry, of that expression as time u, not tau, sorry, as time u goes to infinity, the limit of that expression is finite. So you see here we have the time squared. Right? And we're taking the limit as time goes to infinity. It could be the case that this thing blows up, so it doesn't stay finite. So the result is that the radiation field decays in time quadratically, so that this is finite. And since it decays quadratically in time, it's also integrable in time. So this integral is also finite. Okay. And not only that, but it doesn't matter which angle we are on null infinity. So the result will be a number independent of the angle. And this is a quite important point, that this number does not depend on the angle. So clearly, this integral does not depend on the angle because we integrate over all angles. This term here does depend on the angle. It depends on which null generator on null infinity you are at. But the limit, as time goes to infinity, does not see the angle. So the limits are uniform, are the same for all angles on infinity. OK, so we were able to write down an expression that consists of two terms, one point wise and the other is the integral, which is finite for all black holes, for all Risen-Norton black holes. Now, what is the result? The result is the following. For all scalar perturbations on sub-extreme Risen-Norton, that limit of that expression, so S of C now, is that number, is zero. So that the limit of this expression as U goes to infinity is zero for all perturbations of sub-extreme Risen-Norton.
Sorry, let me ask a question.
Yes.
Yeah. So the Risen-Norton modes of the Risen-Norton depend on the mass and the charge of the black hole. So if you could see those, you would already be able to tell if it is an extreme or a near extreme or what is the charge of your black hole. And the parallel tail that you're studying appears after
yeah.
the exponential decay of the quasi-normal model. So in terms of detectability, it's even a lot harder to detect than the quasi-normal models are. Why are you focusing on the study of the parallel tails?
Okay, I will answer this question to, you shouldn't really believe that my first interest is in finding it, understanding the detectability of extreme black holes. Like, my main priority is understanding the dynamics of extreme black holes.
If you want to study the power law tails, that's fine.
I also want to understand the power law tails. I also want to understand their detectability properties, but mostly I want to understand their dynamics. Okay, and by dynamics, I mean stability and instability. So you will see that this result here is related to the dynamics. Okay, and it tells you things about dynamics of extreme black holes that the quasi-normal modes cannot give you, at least directly. So you use them.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah?
Just to understand something better. Because the sign of the imaginary part of the quasi-normal mode is already giving you the difference between stability or instability at the linear level.
Yeah, no,
thanks. Do you expect that the parallel tail is going to grow instead of that?
Excellent. Very nice. So the quasi-normal modes are, by definition, frequency localized things. So if you want to understand a generic perturbation, you cannot assume that you're localized at that time frequency and azimuthal frequency or spherical frequency. Having the complete distribution of the quasi-normal modes is very useful. But still, one would like to understand, given general initial data, initial perturbations, how these behave in the future. I don't want just to study individual quasi-normal modes.
Okay, because they do not form a complete set.
Exactly. Exactly. Perfect. Excellent. So there is, by the way, ongoing work by one of my collaborators trying to understand how to even define properly quasi-normal modes on extremal asymptotically flat backgrounds and how to understand dynamics, but that's separate. All right. Thank you for your question. So for all scalar perturbations on sub-extreme Risen-Norton, that expression, the limit of the previous expression, is zero. Whereas for generic perturbations of extreme Risen-Norton, the same expression is non-zero. So if we can measure that expression, again, I don't assume any symmetry assumption. I don't say this is supporting on some azimuthal frequency, on some time frequency. For any perturbation, I write that physically, that expression that can be written in physical space, no frequency decomposition here. And if I compute that expression and I get a non-zero number, then I can immediately conclude that that corresponds to perturbation of an extreme black hole. Okay, and again, this number is completely measurable at null infinity. So I don't know anything about the interior. Before I talk more about the mathematics behind this work, let me spend a few minutes to give you some recent numerical confirmation of this result. So Khanna and his collaborators simulate the evolution of the radiation field for a long time and allow them to confirm our result. But most importantly, they obtain interesting extensions of this result. So all the figures I'm going to show you are due to them. so the first one is that this signature, SC, goes to zero for sub-extremal black holes. So this is time, this is a signature, and this is the logarithm of the signature. So the logarithm of the signature goes to minus infinity, which means that the signature goes to zero for sub-extremal black holes. Okay, the ratio is 0.8. Again, now this is the signature, this is time. We have an extremal isonostrum. The signature is the blue curve. Here is the regime of the where the quasi-normal modes are excited, 100 times the mass, for their initial data at least. So after a while, after we have this exponential oscillation, we have that the signature converges to a number which is non-zero. And if we look at the logarithm things, the logarithm of this expression goes to negative infinity, which means that this goes to that number, and not to zero as happened in the sub-extremal case. So these simulations agree with our results. Now, something very important. Our theorem holds for Reisen-Nordström, which is a very simple space-time because it has so many symmetries. Of course, one would like to study the Kerr family, which is more ideal. The mathematics of the Kerr family are more complicated, especially the mathematics of the extremal Kerr family. So we haven't proved this rigorously yet, but Khanna was able to simulate this. And again, almost the exact analog of the signature on axisymmetric perturbations of extremal Kerr. Now, for the extremal Kerr, we need to assume for reasons also that you will see later that our perturbations are axisymmetric. You have the region of the quasi-normal modes, of the dominance of the quasi-normal modes, and then the signature approaches a number which is non-zero.
Sorry, why is it asymptoting to a non-zero value?
Why?
Yeah.
So you're asking me why this is true. So I'm just stating the result first. So I said we have this expression for any fixed time u. I let my time go to infinity, and I get the limit of that expression at infinite time on an infinity. And I said in the sub-extremal case, this limit will always be zero. In the extremal case, it will generically be non-zero. That is the result. Why, we will see a bit later. And again, the why is related to the dynamics of extremal black holes, which is what I'm interested in. So why is extremely important? Oops, sorry.
How should we interpret physically the meaning of this S you define there?
Sorry, how?
You define this quantity as psi, right? So how should we interpret physically? What does it mean?
Physically, it is an expression on null infinity, that's all I can say, that sees the asymptotic behavior of the radiation field, but also sees the radiation field, you know, from time zero up to time infinity. Now, what is the physical interpretation of that expression on null infinity? I don't know. But I will give you more information, more insight about this. When I explain to you why you have this dichotomy, that it's zero at the sub-extremal case and non-zero in the extremal case. Okay, so you.
I mean, right. So if you take the iron case, right, you set the charge to be zero, that should reduce to the curl case, right? And for the curl black hole, we have the solution for all this wave propagation on the curl background.
Okay.
Right. So and what will be the expression for this psi and this s on the curl background?
So the expression for care is, I think, the same. Maybe the constants are a bit different. I don't remember exactly. But it's the same thing. For care, again, you have same, certainly the weight here is the same, like you need to have quadratic time, the integral. Yes.
But do you have an idea what should be the meaning on the curl background?
Like the meaning, like mass, angular momentum of something, I don't know, like something purely physical. But as I said, as I developed the mathematical theory that led us to this expression, you will see more of how,
So,
let's try to answer this question maybe at the end of it. Yes?
Right. So for near extreme occur, so we know there are normals with very small decay rate, right? So if you look at the ring down of these kind of black holes, then you will see that this mode, this family mode will be clearly excited. So usually what you see in the ring down stage is you will have a 1 over t kind of decay for a long time to the point that the dominant mode of that thing is, becomes important or something, and follows some other exponential decay, probably another problem as well. But for extremal black hole, this 1 over t type of decay will last forever because.
Perfect.
If you consider the collecting summation of all modes.
Excellent.
So I'm not sure this S psi you're defining, is it related to this 1 over t kind of decay for extreme over?
Okay, so the 1 over t decay is for this region here. Okay, so it's not the decay rate of the radiation field on all infinity. So it's, let's say, if the event horizon is at r equal 10, the radius equal to 10, then the radius equal to 20, and like you take the region where r is 20, and you just try to track the scalar field along that hypersurface, then it will behave like 1 over t. But the radiation field at infinity will decay like 1 over t squared, or 1 over u squared. And let's say, consider Schwarzschild. What is the decay rate? What is Price's law for Schwarzschild? So in this region, away from the event horizon, second, and from null infinity, so along this region, the scalar field behaves like 1 over t cubed, right? 1 over t to the 3. Whereas the radiation field along null infinity behaves like 1 over t to the 2. So the radiation field for extremal and sub-extremal black holes has the same decay rate. And actually, this is what it helps us that has the same decay rate. Because otherwise, you know, if the decay rate changed, then I wouldn't be able to define the one expression that's finite, like one expression, without changing the weight here. It's finite for both extremal and sub-extremal black holes.
Okay, you're saying there is no qualitative difference between.
Exactly. At null infinity. Exactly. So I wouldn't be able to write a similar expression where r takes the value 100. I wouldn't be able to do this. Now, the interesting results of Khanna is what happens if you consider near extremal black holes. So can we use, can we see some aspects of that signature for near extremal black holes? So let's see what we have here. We have the red line, which is just a constant line. Here is the values of the signature S of C, right? And here is the time U. So let's follow, this is from bottom to top. So let's look at the top curve first. The top curve is the furthest away from extremality. So the thing that's, let's say, quite far away from extremality, which is already only 10 to the minus 5, right? This difference is 10 to the minus 5. And I already said that this is far from extremality. So that curve, the signature of that curve, goes to 0. On the other hand, if we consider extremality, that would be the bottom curve, which is the blue one. So the signature at zero, at extremality, converges to this number, which is non-zero. And what happens now to all these things between them? All these values, of course, are sub-extremal. So all these curves, this is the plot, right, again, of S psi time u. And as u goes to infinity, we get the S of psi. Okay. All of these curves are sub-extremal, are the signature at sub-extremal values, which means that S of psi must go to zero, because this is what happens in sub-extremal case. So all these curves, apart from the blue one, which is the extremal, they eventually go to zero. But the ones that are very close to extremality take a lot of time to go to zero. And here is the blown up version. So blue is the extremality, and all the other things are sub-extremal. So there is a considerable amount of time after the dominance of the quasi-normal modes. So there is a period of an intermediate period where the signature of near extremal black holes is far from zero. So it's very close to the extremal value. And after that intermediate region, the signature goes back to zero. So the hair, let's say, is lost. And we interpret this as a transient observational signature, as a transient signature. It's a signature for near extremal black holes. All right. So the nice thing about these diagrams is that we obtain a quantitative information about this transient behavior. So we can see for what values of the ratio A over M or Q over M, we can indeed obtain properties of the signature which are reminiscent to the extremal signature. So by just looking at the plot of the signature, you can see whether you are a near extremal black hole or not. So let me skip this. So again, by continuing in the same spirit, if we have a sub-extremal black hole, we define that signature, we are at the extremal case, we have the signature, and we take the difference. We'd like to understand how the difference behaves. And now our main goal is to obtain quantitative results so that we can quantitatively capture near extremality. So the first simulation that they did for this is to understand we fix the retardy time, and they just vary the ratio A over M. And they look at the difference of the signature of the black hole from the extremal one. And you see that this difference behaves linearly in the logarithmic plot. And the slope of that line is 1. Which means that this expression here depends linearly on the distance from extremality, on 1 minus A over M. Okay, so here we are fixing our time, and we're simply changing, varying the ratio. And we want to see how the signature behaves as we are varying the ratio. The second thing you would like to do is not to fix your time. So just have your retardy times changing. So here we have, again, the signature. Here we have our time. And this is how the signature behaves. So this is the region where the quasi-normal modes are excited. And then we have the intermediate region, where all these curves approach the sub-extremal value. Now, the interesting thing, so again, it's only the time that changes. These curves correspond to different sub-extremal black holes. The interesting thing is that in the intermediate region, they all follow this pattern, right? They all look like linear lines parallel to this blue one. And the blue one in the logarithmic plot is the 2 times u, so in the axial one is u squared. So combining the two things that I told you, you conclude that the signature for sub-extremal black holes behaves like the signature in the extremal case, plus linear dependence on how far you are from maximality, and quadratic growth in time. And this expression is believed to be true from the simulations in the intermediate region, in the intermediate times, for the intermediate times, after the excitation of the quasi-normal modes and before the dominance of the power tail, of the power law tails. It's in that region. So we have this thing goes to one because it's extremal, let's say. This thing will necessarily go to zero at infinite time. But in that intermediate time, you go from one to something that grows quadratically times something which tells you how far you are from maximality. So you are one, you grow quadratically away from one until you become very small, and then you become really zero. To obtain such a result mathematically, it's almost impossible for various reasons. But the whole key about these things is that, okay, in the extremal case, you can certainly use that signature to distinguish, to confirm that your black hole is extremal. In the sub-extremal case, you can use the signature to differentiate between near extremality and sub-extremality, provided that your distance from extremality is no more than 10 to the minus 6. Okay? So this is what these simulations give.
So we have an estimate of what's the duration of this intermediate stage? Like
perfect.
The scale is your.
So here is the. So it depends on the initial data, but let's say for initial data for which the quasi-normal mode stop being dominant at time 100 m, then this intermediate region for which you have this property is for one order of magnitude more. So it's up to 1 to 2,000 times.
I mean, it has to depend on 1 minus a, right? So if a is close to 1, then I would imagine this duration would be longer. More extreme,
we
got the longer the duration of this transient state, right?
Yes, of course. So, okay, you're right. So, this is true not only for the intermediate region, but it's also true in the case where this value is, 10 to the minus 5, a little bit worse than this. They have a discussion of this in their paper, so you won't. You can, but this is all taken from their papers. But the whole point is that you can try to use the signature to also apply it in a near extremal regime. And by near extremality, in order for this signature to make sense, we mean 10 to the minus 6. That's all I want to say. I could have skipped all the plots and just say this. Okay, so now I will only talk about mathematics. And in particular, I will try to explain to you what is the physical meaning of SOC. And okay, so first we have to start with some background. Late-time asymptotics, and specifically late-time asymptotics on sub-extrema black holes. Think of Schwarzschild. Mathematically, extremely active research area. Tens of contributors that I didn't even list. But we have one result in this direction. So what is the late-time asymptotics for your scalar perturbation on the sub-extremal Eisenhower, including Schwarz? So your scalar field along the event horizon behaves like time to the 1 over 3. 1 over time to the 3. So it behaves like that. And the dominant term in the asymptotic expansion has an 8 times I1 coefficient. So this is the leading order term in the time expansion along the event horizon. What is this coefficient I1 of C? It's this expression of the initial data. So you know the initial data, you know this expression. Generically, this expression will be non-zero. So that will be generically the leading order term in the time expansion along the event horizon. along an r equal constant hypersurface, same decay rate, same coefficient. So in the subextremal case, the asymptotics do not distinguish between the event horizon and further away from the event horizon. You get the exact same asymptotics. If you take the radiation field, the leading order term decays like 1 over t to the 2. Okay, you lose the 3 and you go to 2, which is what we mentioned before, with a slightly different coefficient. It's 2 instead of 8, but this I1 is the same as this one. And you have some logarithmic corrections. These are the asymptotics for the scalar field on a subextremal Reisenhorst spacetime. Again, this psi is a general psi. I'm not assuming any decomposition on frequencies. And this result is independent of understanding quasi-normal modes. OK. This I1 now has an interesting thing. So it depends purely on the initial data, right? Your psi at time zero and the derivative of psi at time zero. So you can write down in terms of the initial data. But you can also write it down in terms of the radiation field. And it's nothing else but the integral of the radiation field. Okay, it's a flux on the integral of the radiation field. So but just rewriting what I said before, the limit of your scalar field multiplied with the correct power of time along the event horizon is given by this constant I1, which is the integral of the radiation field on infinity. The same thing for this limit away from the event horizon, and the same thing for this specific limit of the radiation field. So the nice thing about the reason I rewrote in that form our asymptotics is because they tell you that your late time asymptotics everywhere in your space-time, along the event horizon, away from the event horizon, or null infinity, your asymptotics purely behave on the behavior of the radiation field. And more specifically, the radiation field, of course, lives in the weak field dynamics. Right? So that tells you that the late time asymptotics are dictated by the weak field theory, by the weak field dynamics. So by the dynamics at large are asymptotics determined by dynamics at large R. That's what this tells you.
They're all just the same term multiplied by different factors. Is there a way to understand those factors?
You mean 2m over pi? And
yeah, where are they? All right, so it's funny that they are just some factors that depend on mass in some way times the same number.
I mean, these constants come just from the equations. These constants. Now, the only thing that I would say it's interesting about these constants is that they don't see the charge; they only see the mass. And that's why this signature here, for example, the signature here does not see the charge, and that's the whole point. If it saw the charge, like you would immediately know if it's extremal or subextremal. You only see the mass. If I have time, I could say a little bit more. Yeah, OK, maybe I will not say many things about this slide. But as we saw, it's this constant I1 that gives you the late time asymptotics. Right? It's the coefficient of the asymptotic expression. This I1 expressed here in terms of the initial data, expressed here in terms of radiation field. Now, what is the meaning of this I1? The only thing that I will say is that this I1 is related to the Neumann-Penrose constant on infinity. Okay, the scalar perturbations admit conserved quantities along null infinity, which are known as Neumann-Penrose constants. And these constants are very closely related to this number I1, which was what determined the asymptotics. But maybe I will not spend more on this because I will not have time to talk about extremal black holes. So now, I would like to discuss the asymptotics in the extremal case. The things I told you before with this I1 constant were about sub-extremal black holes. Now, in the extremal case, the new thing is that there is a conservation law, not only on null infinity, which is the Neumann-Penrose constant, but there is also a conservation law that I will try to explain now on the event horizon. So the event horizon is a cylinder. So it is time times a sphere. Now, on any such sphere, we can consider transversal vector fields, the blue ones. And on every such individual sphere, S tau, let's say, we can consider an integral over that sphere of an expression that involves our scalar field and that transversal derivative, that blue vector field of the scalar field. So why is that blue vector? And what is interesting is that this integral now is conserved. In other words, it doesn't change by changing the sphere of integration. So if your initial data were such that the value of that integral at the sphere S0 was 1, then the value of that integral on any sphere, on any section of the event horizon, will always be 1. And that immediately, mathematically, is translated as a non-decay result. Because if you have an integral on every such sphere being equal to 1, that means that your scalar field does not decay. Because if it decayed, this would go to 0, this would go to 0, the whole integral would go to 0 because the volume is finite. So the integral would go to 0, which means it's not conserved. It's not always equal to 1. So you have a conservation law on the event horizon. This conserved constant, which is completely determined by the initial data, just evaluate this integral at the initial section of the event horizon, as you, we will call it h of psi. Okay, h of psi. And we will consider, of course, the generic perturbations for which this constant is non-zero. Here are the asymptotics now for scalar for these scalar perturbations on the extremal background. So the scalar perturbation, the scalar thing itself, behaves like 1 over time. It's not 1 over t squared or 3, it's 1 over time. This is along the event horizon. Okay. So as you have seen, it's along the event horizon. Scalar field is 1 over time. And the coefficient, so the thing that determines this asymptotic term, is h. Is that conserved quantity here? Now, if you consider the transversal vector field, y, why was that blue vector field that I showed you earlier? That blue derivative of psi in time along the event horizon converges to this number, converges to h. So you have now a non-decay result for first order derivatives of psi. And if you take two transversal derivatives of psi along the event horizon, then you have a blow-up. Okay, you have something that grows linearly in time, and the coefficient is again that expression h, which is non-zero generic. So you have slow decay, you have non-decay, and you have blow-up results for scalar perturbations along the event horizon of an extremal black hole. This growth of perturbations and derivatives of perturbations, we call it horizon instability of an extremal Rasmussen black hole. This H now can be thought of as a horizon hair. Horizon in the sense that away from the black hole, all the expressions go to zero. This would be an arrow, not less recorded. All the expressions go to zero. So the perturbation will not leave any trace of itself. At infinite time, will go to zero, away from the black hole. But away from the event horizon. But along the event horizon, the perturbation will tend, like an expression of the perturbation, will tend to a number. So we'll leave a trace. That trace, we'll call it a hair. And because it happens only on the horizon, we'll call it a horizon hair. And that expression h is related to a term of the energy momentum tensor. So it also can be thought as energy density measured by incoming observers. So it has some physical meaning. Okay, there have been various extensions and applications of this kind of result, by various people. okay. Now, we have this instability result for extremal black holes. And the whole point is that this instability result, you know, tells you a lot about the dynamics of extremal black holes. And although it tells you that extremal black holes are somehow, at least at the horizon, unstable, the nice thing about this result is that it provides a property of the black hole that you could use to see if you can detect the extremal black holes. Although it provides a result that tells you it's unstable, you use that instability to see if it acts as an observational mechanism. So this picture that I have here will now be connected with the picture I showed you in the beginning about the observational signature of extremal black holes. In other words, we will now connect this number h of psi, which is an expression at the horizon, and led to this instability results at the horizon with the signature S of psi but differentiated between extremal and sub-extremal black holes at null infinity. Okay, let me skip this. Here we are. All right, this is just some mathematics. Let me skip them. And let me go directly here. So the signature is precisely that number 8. Okay? So in the extremal case, that expression that I gave you of the radiation field initially, at the beginning of my talk, that expression S of psi, its value coincides with the value of the conserved quantity at the event horizon. This is for the extremal case. In the sub-extremal case, you can still write down that expression at null infinity, but in the sub-extremal case, there is no conservation law on the event horizon. H doesn't even make sense in the sub-extremal case. Like, you can write down the integrals, but they are not conserved anymore. So there is no, you cannot make sense of a constant in the sub-extremal case. But if you write this number in the sub-extremal case, what you will get is the number 0. So in the sub-extremal case, this doesn't make sense, but the value of this number is 0. In the extremal case, both of these things make sense, and they are equal. Okay, so this is how we connect the two worlds now, the things that are measured at infinity and the things that are measured at the horizon. And the connection is precisely this question here. So three conclusions, and I am done. Maybe I'm done early, I don't know. Is the following, that in a classical sense, okay, I'm not trying to cheat here, but information at the horizon can be read or leaks all the way to null infinity. So this is something purely localized at the horizon, involving one transversal derivative of the event horizon, and this is purely read by the radiation field at null infinity. So these two expressions are equal, right? So information from event horizon can be leaked all the way to null infinity. The other thing we can conclude is that extremal black holes admit classical externally measurable hair. So H is that hair that I talked to you about. You have perturbations which leave a trace at infinite time. It's that number H at the event horizon. And it is classical. This is just classical theory, nothing else. And it is externally measurable in the sense that observers at null infinity can measure that hair, because simply that here is equal to that expression of null infinity, at null infinity. And the last comment is okay, you know, this aspirational comment that could serve as an observational signature for extremal black holes, because precisely if you can just calculate that number S of psi, then you can conclude that your black hole is extremal. And it can also help you define near extremality, again, based on the work of the simulations that I showed you before. Okay, these are the three conclusions. Oh, we also have some further extensions that I want to talk to you about. So Harvey Real and his collaborators have done some nonlinear simulations that suggested or showed that this horizon instability for extremal radiation Nordstrom also persists in the nonlinear case, where you consider the Einstein-Maxwell scalar field system in a neighborhood of extremal radiation Nordstrom. So if your scalar field is 0, you get Einstein-Maxwell, which gives you exactly extremal radiation Nordstrom. So what they consider is just a couple that system with scalar field, and they took very small scalar field. So it's a perturbation of extremal radiation Nordstrom. And they found that this spherically symmetric, this is all spherical symmetry. The spherically symmetric perturbations of extremal radiation Nordstrom exhibit the horizon stability that I showed you before on the event horizon. Things decay slowly, things don't decay, things grow on the event horizon. The second thing I would like to mention is work by Casals, Grala, and Zimmermann, who showed the following. So let me show you one more thing. Okay, so let's see here the decay rate of the scalar perturbation itself, not derivatives, of the perturbation itself is 1 over time. This is for extremal radiation Nordstrom. What about extremal care? Okay, so for extremal KL is again 1 over time for axisymmetric perturbations. But for non-axisymmetric perturbations with non-zero azimuthal frequency, the decay rate is even slower. It's 1 over square root of time. And the first order transversal derivative, that blue vector field that I showed you before, is not going to a non-zero number. It's not just non-decaying, as was previously the case. But for non-axisymmetric perturbations of extremal care, that first order derivative grows already like the square root of time. So this is an amplified version of the horizon instability. It has not been shown mathematically, but this is what their semi-analytical work produced. And Grala and Zimmermann provided more recently a systematic approach to obtain the decay rates, like why this is 1 over, why the power here is a half. And they associated these rates or these rates of decay or growth to various scaling properties of extremal backgrounds. In any case, these results, even to be proved mathematically, are very interesting. Let me just finish with one comment that even this 1 over t decay is true for fixed non-zero azimuthal frequencies. So this is still a frequency localized result for extremal care. If you consider a general perturbation without any restriction on frequencies, just very general perturbation, then we have no information as to, no insight as to what is its late time behavior. It could be 1 over log t, it could be that it's not decaying at all, it could be that it's growing. So in other words, we don't know mathematically or physically what is the late time behavior of a general solution to the linear wave equation on extremal care. Without any symmetry assumptions. Okay, that's what I want to say. These are my kids. And thank you.
Depend on the fact that you assuming the initial perturbation, saying you assume like the psi is zero at infinity.
How is
it? Initially has a compact support.
Perfect. So, okay, I assume that the initial data are compact supported for the talk, just to make it easier. But I mean, the result holds even if the data are supported all the way up to infinity. It's just that they have to decay appropriately.
Okay.
So that some energy norms are finite.
Because now there's this proposal saying the dark matter might be composed of a scalar field, right? So in that case, you will see like even a Schwarzschild black hole can develop a scalar hair from the distribution of the scalar field of the dark matter. So in this case, how would this extremal black hole, the hair has something different than you would expect from a normal Schwarzschild black hole?
I don't know exactly what you mean, but I can only say that. One second.
I suppose they have a constant psi background or whatever. And you can solve for the Klein-Gordon equation near the, say, a Schwarzschild black hole. And you'll find there will be a scalar hair.
I mean, even for Schwarzschild, you don't have exactly here. You have this Newman-Penrose constant that I mentioned. This Newman-Penrose constant, what is it? It's this expression here. It's you go at null infinity, which is what you are interested in. You go at the sphere at infinity, radius infinity. And you take the outgoing derivative. You rescale it appropriately so that you don't get zero, so that you get something that's finite. Not zero, but not infinity, some finite, and you integrate over that infinite sphere. That number here will be conserved along all spheres of null infinity. So there is somehow a hair associated to your scalar perturbation. It's just that if your initial data are decaying sufficiently fast towards infinity, then this integral itself will be zero. So what the thing that is propagated in time along null infinity will be zero. And this is the case for compactly supported initial data. For the results that I've produced today, all basically I want to hold is that your psi decays sufficiently at infinity so that this integral that is conserved in time is zero. If it is non-zero, which means now that our data are supported at null infinity in a rescaled sense, or really non-zero, then we have the asymptotics, but the asymptotics will also see that Neumann-Penrose constant associated to psi. They will also see that here associated to psi. And in that case, you can still distinguish between extremality and sub-extremality just because the asymptotics are different in the extremal and sub-extremal case.
So you identify this quantity, in a sense you want to kind of present as if it's a narrow hair, you can extract out of the Hilbert curve. Is it your sense that this is it? In that, could there be other quantities going to add gradients of the field or something that you could allow you to extract, for instance, as you mentioned, this only knows about the mass, but doesn't know about the charge, where this is exhausting, but there are no other combinations or the field that will give you something else?
So this is the integral over the sphere. These coefficients here are numbers. So this number only depends on the spherical mean of C, like the zero angular spherical harmonic. So if we consider any other spherical frequency, then we have a conservation law associated to that frequency, which is different from that. So we have a hierarchy of conservation laws depending on the angular number. Apart from these conservation laws, I don't know anything else. I don't know any other here that one can find.
Sorry, maybe I don't understand exactly what do you mean by hair here, because it depends on you having an initial scalar field, an initial perturbation, right? In that case, it's not actually hair that belongs to the black hole on its own.
Yeah, perfect. It's a hair of the perturbation of the black hole, not of it. Like it's not the actual. It's like the, but in the sense that perturbations of black holes would vanish, and the only thing that would remain would be properties of the black holes or the black hole. Whereas now we have perturbations of black holes, which, you know, they still remain. Even after infinite time, at infinite time, you don't only get back your initial unperturbed black hole, but you also get something more. And that thing, although in reality is a property of the perturbation, that thing, I think of it as a property of the black hole itself, because it was the perturbation of that black hole that led to that extra information at infinity that did not vanish. That's it.
I could consider different types of perturbation, like magnetic perturbation, other fields. Right?
Yeah. The thing is not that, like, I understand different perturbations will give you different numbers, but the thing is that if you consider those perturbations in the sub-extremal case, then they will all disappear. Whereas in the extremal case, those perturbations, they will leave something behind. So that thing that stays behind, we think of it as an extra hair of the black hole. Again, this is now just for the purpose of understanding the result. I'm not trying to say that.
Okay, so it's just related to the dynamics at infinity.
Exactly. It's mathematically, it's the dynamics at infinity. Just to make it more physics friendly. Say here. That would be the next step, but at the moment we don't have the result. But that would be. Because this instability itself, like the conserved quantities H, the instabilities hold for linearized perturbations. So the Tukoski equation sees these things. The next thing would go to infinity.
Thanks, Thomas, again.
Thank you.